Thanks for listening to Only a Game. We'd like to better understand who is listening and how you're using podcasts. Please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. That's all one word. It takes less than 10 minutes and really helps support the show. That's npr.org/podcast survey. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. For more than three decades, no American woman won the Boston Marathon. Heading into last year's race, Des Linden was one of three runners with a good chance to break that drought. She was 34 years old, a two-time Olympian with an impressive running resume, and she had nearly won the race in 2011, coming up 2 seconds short after a sprint to the finish. But she almost didn't make it to the start of the 2018 Boston Marathon because of something that happened 10 months earlier in July of 2017 in a race on the other side of the world. Only a Game's Shira Springer picks up the story from there.
It was the kind of race day that runners dream about. Beautiful weather, flat course, enthusiastic crowds, perfect conditions for fast times. That's why, standing at the start of the 2017 Gold Coast Half Marathon in Australia, Des Linden told herself, "I'm going to knock it out of the park." But she didn't, not even close.
You know, just in the first couple miles, it was like, I feel so sluggish, I feel so slow, just so lethargic. And then the motivation was just like, what's the point? Like, why do I care so much? Like, really, if I win this half marathon, change my life? Eh. Like, I just didn't care.
Mile after mile, as Linden raced along scenic surf beaches, past Runaway Bay, and around Paradise Point, the lack of motivation became more intense.
And by the end, I was like, I could be done.
Did you really think that might be it for your career at that point?
Yeah. I mean, I just no passion at all.
Okay, how alarming was that? It's not like it happens overnight, but it kind of happens in the course of an hour and 10, 11 minute run. I mean, you go from world-class runner, professional runner, two-time Olympian to this might be over.
Yeah. I feel like it was a thing I had been putting a Band-Aid on for a long time, and it was just finally like, we've bled out. The Band-Aid's not going to work anymore. Like, you need to go get the stitches. This has been a bigger problem for a long time.
The Gold Coast Half Marathon came after 2 years of intense training for big races. First, the U.S. Olympic trials, where she finished second. Then the 2016 Rio Olympic Marathon, where she placed seventh. Then the 2017 Boston Marathon, where she was fourth. Pretty good, right? But Linden felt frustrated. She was in the best shape of her life, and she wanted better results.
By the end of Boston, it was like, okay, I know the fitness is there. Like, we just need to tweak things. Like, let's go. Let's, like, keep knocking our head against the wall here and we'll figure it out.
After Boston, Linden took a shorter break than usual from training, just 2 weeks. Then, she didn't gradually build back her mileage. She ramped it up right away.
That probably kicked me in the butt.
And it left her shattered after the Gold Coast Half Marathon.
Like, I'm not a crier, but I finished and I was like, and in tears, because it's hard. You're like, I think my body's done. Like, I think mentally I'm done. Like, clearly, physically, like, not responding. I hate how much work I'm putting into this to have a horrible experience and tarnish a thing I really love.
Linden went back to her hotel room and talked to her husband, Ryan. She had questions.
Why am I so tired? How did I get so bad at this? Like, what happened that I got this bad? Like, what's going on? It didn't make a lot of sense.
Still, Linden considered entering a fall marathon. Why? Because for marathoners accustomed to pushing past the pain and the fatigue and the self-doubt, the hardest thing to do is take time off, to recover, really recover, especially when running is your job. But when she was honest with herself, Linden knew running a fall marathon wouldn't solve anything. She was burned out. She needed a break from the grind, a break where she ran when she wanted to and didn't run when she didn't feel like it.
That was the process of the summer of 17.
Some days she went for a run. Some days she headed out the door, then changed her mind, went back home, and did something else. She spent a lot of time on Lake Michigan near her home in Charlevoix. She played with her dogs. She read. She stayed up late, drank good bourbon, and ate unhealthy food. She fished. She kayaked.
My thing is always to go out to Fisherman's Island, usually by myself. And it's quiet. It's very, very empty out there. Yeah, very peaceful.
And while she was out there on the water, the Great Lake that she says turns Caribbean blue and green in the summer, she didn't think about much. She certainly didn't think about her running career.
It was just go kayak and not worry about what's back on shore.
Her husband Ryan, agent Josh Cox, and sister Natalie Davila were there to offer support whenever needed. But Lyndon didn't make that easy.
I didn't want someone to talk me through it. I didn't want someone to be supportive. I just wanted to be, like, pissed. And their way of supporting it was saying, that's fine. Like, you can be pissed. And I look back and I'm like, man, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry I was such a bad person.
Lyndon remembers an argument with her agent. She wasn't happy about Cox updating her personal calendar and causing her phone to buzz.
And I'm like, yeah, well, don't, like, just delete all the calendars. Like, I don't want anything anymore. Like, I got it. I'll figure it out. Like, don't do anything. Stop trying to help me. I don't know if it was like, I don't deserve it, or I don't want you to invest in me right now as an agent. So I'm like, just don't help me. I think I'm done. Like, I'm probably done. So don't waste your time being an agent for me.
Lyndon didn't run a single day in August 2017. Then, in September, she started stringing running days together, and it felt good. She ran 10 days in a row, and it still felt good. Every day she wanted to be out there on familiar roads in Charlevoix, and it wasn't long before Lyndon reestablished a training routine. By late September, she started thinking about putting a race on her calendar, and she says that was
super daunting to be like, what if I go out there and it's even worse?
Lyndon's first event back was a cross-country race in Boston. She hadn't run cross-country since her college days at Arizona State more than a decade earlier.
You go somewhere where you can't compare yourself to yourself in the past, to anything you've done before. And you go somewhere that makes you happy and has good feelings associated with it. And that was being in Boston and running the Mayor's Cup cross-country.
She didn't win. She finished fifth. But she discovered something.
Oh, I still can do this. Like, physically, there's stuff there, whether it's great or not. I can physically do it, and it's fun. Like, it's actually really fun. Like, I love competing, and I didn't have to worry about the stopwatch or, you know, a split or whatever it was. It was like, just go and try to beat some people.
During the fall of 2017, she tested herself in other short races. Then Lyndon set her sights on the 2018 Boston Marathon. And she says she was laid back about her training.
Let's not do the 125 mile weeks. Let's go 120, 115. That's fine.
Her goal? Reach Marathon Monday feeling fresh and eager to compete.
It is wet and chilly out here. I was going to say the rain had slowed down a little bit a few minutes ago, but now it's picking up again and the wind is gusty.
As it turned out, April 16th, 2018 was the kind of race day that runners dread. Temperatures hovered around the high 30s. Headwinds gusted to 35 miles per hour, and torrential rains drenched the 26.2 miles from Hopkinton to Boston. And the weather thinned the big crowds that usually line the course.
It was so bad that it was comical, like the rain just dumping on you. You're soaking wet, like, I don't know, after 1 minute out there, and you know, we have a few hours ahead of us. We're wearing jackets, like, this is going to be a long day.
It had been 33 years since an American woman had won. And early on, Lyndon sensed it wasn't going to be her day. Around mile six, she told fellow American Shalane Flanagan that she might drop out. She also said, if you need something, let me know. Shortly before the half marathon mark, Flanagan made her now infamous porta potty stop.
I don't know that I've seen that in the situation that we're in right now. No, I
haven't. Lyndon slowed to wait for Flanagan.
There's little doubt in my mind that Des Lyndon waited for Shalane to help her work her way back up to this pack, which really split apart.
Around the same time, Lyndon saw another American runner, Serena Burla, do something even crazier. Lyndon told the story at a recent live event in Boston. Burla had started the race in a singlet and shorts, no jacket, and
she realized she wasn't going to get to the finish in what she was wearing. Like, she was going to get hypothermic. So Serena sees a trash can and is like, I'm going to get the trash bag
empty it out, punch a hole in it, and wear it. She wore it the rest of the race. But I'm looking back at Shalane's running in the bathroom, and there's this bag like billowing. I'm like, what is happening? This is a circus. Like.
Then, during mile 21, right after Heartbreak Hill,
as they have about 8K to go, Lyndon now gets to the front. I'm surprised at this, Al. Just tuck in behind Chasseur, but nonetheless, let's see if she's trying to put a surge on and break away.
And she's doing it.
From there, Lyndon pushed to the finish. As she ran through Cleveland Circle and Coolidge Corner and Kenmore Square, she extended her lead. By the time Lyndon passed Fenway Park, her closest competitors were minutes behind. Her stride was easy and confident, her head up, her eyes focused on the empty road ahead. Lyndon turned right on Hereford Street, left on Boylston Street, and saw the finish.
The rain continues to come down, and now the drought is over. An American woman wins Boston as Lyndon wins in Boston.
Lyndon's husband Ryan and agent Josh Cox rushed to embrace the new Boston Marathon champion. And for the second time in less than a year, there were tears at the finish line. On the race broadcast, amid all the cheers, you can just barely hear them tell Lyndon, "You deserve this. I'm so proud of you." And they were talking about more than the result.
That's only a game's Shira Springer. Des Lyndon will be back in Boston to defend her title on April 15th. Do you know what helps recreational marathoners pass the time during those long runs on the weekends? The Only a Game podcast. Or at least, that's what my friends who still go on long runs on the weekends tell me. Hi, Tina. Hi, Tiffany. If you're looking for a good way to pass the time while running or driving or cleaning the house, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast. It's the best way to make sure you never miss a second of our show. Former University of Texas El Paso football player Jean-Andre Moore has written music since third grade.
I changed the lyrics to Mambo No. 5 to talk about all the fish. A little bit of coho in my life, a little bit of Chinook by my side, a little bit of rainbow's what I need.
More recently, Jean-Andre helped make a rap about a historic college basketball team. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Simon & Schuster, presenting this message. Simon & Schuster, publisher of Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. This New York Times best-selling biography of Tiger Woods is sourced from years of reporting and more than 250 interviews, chronicling the life and career of the championship golfer, including his childhood, rise to fame, and success on the golf course and business world, his public downfall, and ongoing comeback. Tiger Woods is available in paperback, ebook, and as an audiobook.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another. And this month, we're celebrating women in comedy. And this week, from the Netflix series Russian Doll, we're joined by co-creator Leslie Headland and actor Greta Lee. We challenge them to not one, but two games about real nesting dolls and fashionable food trends. Listen and subscribe now.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. On March 24th, the Calgary Inferno of the Canadian Women's Hockey League won the Clarkson Cup for the second time. A week later, the CWHL announced that it's folding. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed via Skype and by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Karen. Hi, Ken.
Shireen, start us off.
The Calgary Inferno are a powerhouse team in the CWHL. They beat Les Canadiens 5-2 in a thrilling match of the Clarkson Cup that was watched by over 170,000 people over three networks.
Wow.
So this came as a shock, not only to the legions of fans who support women's hockey in Canada, the team players of the six teams were finding out via social media if they hadn't found out 20 minutes before. No sooner did this happen, because the drama never ends, The NWHL's commissioner, Danny Rylan, announced that partnered along with the NHL, they would be expanding their teams to Toronto and Montreal. So, my friends, that's where we are, still trying to navigate through all the feelings.
Shireen, I can't help but think back to the excitement when the CWHL first passed out paychecks in December of 2017. Like, yeah. Do you remember all those tweets and just the beaming faces? And, you know, you mentioned that the NHL has pledged more money, although it's unclear whether they're actually pledging more money than they were previously giving to these two leagues, or if they're just giving all of that funding to one league instead. For me, I think that there's a real point of failure here, and that's in what national governing bodies, or at least USA Hockey, is doing and not doing to support the women's game. You know, the women here have fought for and earned better salaries. The national team players are now getting about $71,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But the organization doesn't promote them well, has a history of failing to take advantage of media opportunities. How important is support of the national governing bodies in the success of pro leagues like the CWHL?
Well, I mean, that's a really important point that you just touched on. What happens is that for convenience sake, we look to support the women only at Olympics time or Worlds. That's not good enough. The CWHL filled a massive canyon of possibility and opportunity for young girls who can see themselves represented as professional hockey players in a league that did not rely on a men's league.
It is important to have the pro level for somebody to say, I can go even further with this. The idea that you have something for kids, girls in this case, to aspire to. So there is an interesting thought process there about the NGB, the national governing body, supporting these leagues and making sure they get going. This has been a blip on the screen. This has not been any time at all. The NFL is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. So it takes time for these things to evolve.
Nothing grows overnight. It needs investment. This particular league was not given a chance to thrive, and that's unfortunate, and it's terrible.
Ken, you wanted to talk about another league that has folded this week.
The Alliance of American Football. So we've seen in the past the American Football League, which merged with the NFL, the World Football League, the United States Football League, and then we had an iteration of the XFL, which is coming back, which is part of the story too. So 53 days into this season, the league has greater trouble than they had in week one, where they couldn't make payroll. So there were signs there were going to be problems. What starts to happen is the cash flow is a problem. And the league looks to the owner of a National Hockey League franchise, getting back to hockey, the Hurricanes, a writer for The Ringer, Roger Sherman, said, if you want to remember this guy's name, think of the theme for Law & Order, Tom Dundon.
Also should have been a sign, maybe.
Yeah, right. There's nothing good happens after you hear Dundon, right? So he invests $70 million and commits that he'll also put in $180 million along the way. He then also becomes chairman, controls the league. He says, well, if we don't get a deal with the NFL, then I'm going to shutter the league. And then he does it. Other little startups like the Historical Basketball League are stuttering a little bit, and investors are saying, I don't know if I want to get into this. If this league is failing, maybe it's time to stop trying to start new leagues.
One of the things for me that stands out the most is I'm thinking about the players.
Yeah.
From what I read, their belongings were packed up and moved into the lobby of hotels.
Yeah.
Like, we forget that they're humans with families that have to move, that have to pay their own bills. Like, it's just, I think sometimes that's forgotten in the discussion and in the analysis, is that how it affects them.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that Tom Dundon made this move to protect what was left of his $250 million investment and not thinking about the people who had made investments of their time and their bodies into this league. I actually also worry that people are going to take this as a sign that we don't need another football league in the United States. And I actually think we desperately need one other league, and it's not the XFL. I think we need Pacific Pro Football, which is another league which is slated to begin next year. The only players eligible to play in that league are those who have been out of high school for less than 4 years. So in other words, the players who are right now being forced to pretend to be college students. And I'm a little bit worried that this whole Alliance of American Football mess is going to make that league more difficult to get off the ground. Ken, are you also looking forward to an actual alternative to college?
Well, there's a niche moment. I think you're right in this idea of, you know, the death of amateurism, which is part of what the Pacific League is focused on. Because really, if you want to make it the NFL, NCAA football is the path. So it is something to think about. Is there another way? Is there something else that kids should have? The idea of trying to have another pro league at the NFL level, the NBA level, Major League Baseball, forget about it. You are not going to win that fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of amateurism, the NCAA places a March Madness rug in every team locker room, and this year they've become a hot commodity. I'm kind of confused how, because they're 3-foot by 5-foot rugs, which feel like they're probably awkward to fit into a suitcase, but still they have been disappearing. And on Sunday, Iowa's Jordan Bohannon tweeted the following, quote, "Give us the ability to make money off our own name and we'll give you your rug back. You have 24 hours.
The boss move right there.
For me, this was great fun. Bohannon wasn't asking his school to pay athletes. He was only asking for players to have the opportunity to make money off their own likenesses. Bohannon later apologized for his joke, apparently at the request of the University of Iowa. But still, most everyone has had a good laugh over this. You know, 5 years ago, I think Bohannon's tweet would have caused scandal. Any talk by a player about being paid was sacrilegious. Now we can at least have a good laugh at it. And I'm just kind of wondering, is that progress or is that the opposite of progress?
Well, I really am rooting for him in the rug. Well, I was. and I think that this speaks to what you're saying, Karen. Could this have happened 5 years ago? The amount of agency the kids have to speak now. Like, I mean, they can't get paid. Can they at least express what they're feeling via social media? There's something about that I like. I'm glad that they're doing it because the NCAA doesn't have a culture of amplifying voices of athletes. Like, these boys just want a rug. Like, I mean, they're not asking for a Bentley. They're like, can we have a rug? I just didn't think it was a stretch, but I don't make the NCAA policies, right? So I don't know.
You know, there's two stories here. I mean, there's the serious free speech part. The other story is the kid wants to decorate his dorm room, for crying out loud. This is, you know, at the risk of the statute of limitations not being up. At Stanford, we used to stay at Ricky's Hyatt House in Palo Alto the night before games, and I guess so they could keep an eye on us. And as a result, most of the team had their own dorm rooms and apartments furnished in early Ricky's Hyatt House. So this is what kids do. And it's they're giving away everything else. They get these goodie bags. So how could they not want you to take that nasty rug that's available there?
For the record, the NCAA does seem to be A-okay with Jordan Bohannon keeping the rug, which is great. I just wish he wasn't being forced to apologize by his school.
Yeah,
exactly.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed, co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Stand by, the game is underway.
It was March 19th, 1966, just a year after the voting rights marches from Selma to Montgomery. Texas Western and Kentucky were playing in the men's college basketball championship game. Kentucky came from the segregated Southeastern Conference. All of their players were white. Texas Western, meanwhile, started 5 black players, a first for the NCAA title game. Texas Western, now the University of Texas at El Paso, won 72-65. 3 years ago, around the 50th anniversary of the game, President Barack Obama honored the team with a video tribute.
They didn't know it at the time, but their contribution to civil rights was as important as any other.
If that wasn't enough, that 1966 Texas Western team is now celebrated in rap. There was something to see with Big Daddy D, with Harry, the Willie, Zendo. There was young
Neville Shedd, on the team that was led by a point guard they call Bobby Joe. On the team from 66.
Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story of how the song came to be.
Wide receiver Jean-Andre Moore walked onto the football team at Division I University of Texas El Paso. He played for the Miners during the 2016 and 17 seasons.
Played is a loose term, but I was on the team, yes.
What was your role?
I was a practice guy. I love practicing.
Jean-Andre also loves music. He says he started taking piano lessons when he was 3. In the 3rd grade, he even wrote a song for a school project about fish.
I changed the lyrics to Mambo Number 5 to talk about all the fish. So it's like a little bit of coho in my life, a little bit of Chinook by my side, a little bit of rainbow's what I need.
When his football career ended, Jean-Andre turned his focus to music. He got cast in a UTEP production of A Chorus Line. And around the same time, he received an email with a request from a guy he'd never met. The guy's name was David Snell, and he wanted help making a rap.
Did you know right away in that initial email that David was 82 years old?
No idea at all. No idea. Talking on the phone is the first time I kind of like clicked. I was like, oh, I mean, he might be like on the older end of things, but I had literally no idea.
82 years old, right in the heart of rap country, 82 years old.
That's David Snell. And for the record, he's 82 now, but he would have been a spry 81 back when he first contacted Jean-Andre. David grew up in Michigan, the son of a Methodist minister and a stay-at-home mom. He always had a knack for writing what he calls end-rhyme poetry.
Our high school football team was bad, and so I wrote a thing for the weekly banner that said, "Win or lose, we're proud of yous. This poem is not so hot, but the reason why we're proud is because you gave it all you got." And you won't find that in the great poetry books of our time anyplace, so you've got it exclusively.
In 1966, David started working at ABC News. He says he covered everything from Vietnam to Richard Nixon to Apollo missions. He left ABC in 1979 and started working as a communications consultant. That's how he met and became friends with a guy who'd been a manager for the 1966 Kentucky team that lost to Texas Western.
And over a period of, I've known him for 30 years, I'd heard so many stories that I said, there's got to be a book in this.
David interviewed players from that 1966 Texas Western team. The Miners' starting lineup in the title game was Bobby Joe Hill, David Big Daddy D. Latin, Willie Worsley, Harry Flournoy, and Orston Artist. Willie Cager and Neville Shedd came off the bench.
And so little by little, I had pieces of the poem running around in my head. Once I got the first part, they were something to see with Big Daddy D, with Harry, the Willies, and O. You know, it just started to flow in that way.
David's book came out in 2016, and it was accompanied by a poem, which he sent to the Texas Western players. He says they enjoyed it, and he thought that was the end of it. But after about a year passed, and with another college basketball season starting up, David thought about how he might be able to promote his book again.
And then suddenly I thought, well, you know, what can I do with that poem? So it kind of sounds like a rap, and I talked to my son about it, and he said, yeah, well, maybe.
David didn't know much about rap, but the idea stuck.
Part of my interest in doing the whole thing was whether it sells a book or not. I thought that there ought to be something that is there historically, that another 50 years down the road, someone might, they might not pick up the book, but they might hear the rap. Who knows?
So David started looking for someone who could do the job.
As you might suspect, when an 82-year-old man starts looking for a rapper, he doesn't know quite where to look.
Finally, he reached out to a friend in El Paso.
He said, yeah, I've got just the guy.
And that guy was Jean-Andre Moore. Now, Jean-Andre wasn't a rapper, but he knew about the 1966 Texas Western team, and he was game to take on the project.
When I read his words, it already had rhythm to it. Yeah, let me tell you the story of a team of glory and the history that they made. One day, when Tiny Texas Western playing Mighty Kentucky to the champions of the NCAA, like, that's, they'd had flow.
Jean-André still had to come up with the chorus. For inspiration, he turned to some of the music he'd grown up listening to.
I hadn't written a chorus myself before, and I kept listening to all these other things. I was like, oh, you really just need to get, like, something that could be repeated, like, a mantra repeated over and over and over again. And that's why I was like, out in El Paso, people always call the 66 team. There's a bar, actually, across from UTEP called Spirit of 66. I was like, oh, well, duh, let's just repeat that over and over again through the chorus and stuff. And so that's what clicked for me in there. I mean, that was with the team of 66. 66, 66, it was a team from 66.
66, 66. On the tip of 66.
After he finished the song, he sent the audio to David.
You know, what he did with it was just really good.
Jean-André thought that was maybe the end of the project. But David had more in mind, a music video.
And he was like, oh, we could do a video too. And I was like, oh, you know, I have to do it. But if you want to do it, I guess we can do it.
David flew to El Paso. Jean-André's girlfriend at the time shot the scenes on her iPhone.
Once we got into it, like, it was so fun, honestly.
He comes across as a very strong performer. It's hard to believe that that's the first time he'd ever done anything like that.
Jean-André graduated from UTEP this past winter. He's now working as an entertainer at a piano bar in Houston and pursuing a career in musical theater. He says he recently got cast in a production of Mamma Mia. And he says he's glad he got to play a part in celebrating a proud moment in his alma mater's history.
The other part of it is, I mean, this is huge for civil rights and, like, for an African-American like myself to go out there and get a chance to, like, pay homage to these, gosh, I'm getting all welled up right here. That's crazy. To get a chance to show out for everyone else and show out for Black culture is huge for me.
There was something to see with Big Daddy D, with Harry the Willy Zendo.
That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. David Snell's book is titled The Baron and the Bear. And of course, we'll have a link to Jean-André Moore's music video at onlyagame.org. When ESPN's Wright Thompson was 9, he joined his dad in front of the TV to watch Jack Nicklaus win the 1986 Masters.
We had a moment that was so loaded with meaning that he didn't even have to explain it.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Welcome to the 21st century.
Do you see Jesus in the burnt toast?
Do you realize that literally there's a bucket of condoms by the exit?
Why is this happening? Why is this happening to me?
We cannot just say stop, I want to get off.
Invisibilia, season 5.
No easy answers, just the right questions.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, lots of Ethiopian children dream of becoming professional runners. We meet one who was adopted into one of this country's premier running families. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Minneapolis was looking forward to welcoming Zion Williamson and Duke to town this weekend for the men's Final Four. Oops.
I'm terribly sorry that Michigan State has managed to harsh everyone's mellow for this. But, you know, Michigan State was a better team. Zion Williamson, God love him, is an enormous talent. But I look at him and I see Charles Barkley. I see Karl Malone. I don't see this unprecedented beast that ate basketball. I mean, I saw Bill Walton play in college. I saw Michael Jordan play in college. Zion Williamson is a great player. He's going to make a lot of money. But let's all settle down.
Well, some say he has the potential to earn $1 billion, that's billion with a B, over the course of his NBA career. Is there any way he could ever live up to all the hype?
Well, I don't know about living up to the hype, but I think they're right about how much money he's going to make. First of all, let's never minimize the importance of having a really cool name.
Right.
And he has a really cool name. Okay, so his ancillary income is going to be through the roof. He's going to do fine. I wouldn't be surprised if he made $1 billion.
What would March Madness be without a story about the NCAA getting a bit overzealous with their amateurism rules? The latest kerfuffle involves Virginia's Kyle Guy. What was Kyle's infraction?
Kyle's getting married, okay?
Good for Kyle.
To the lovely Alexa Jenkins. And like most betrothed couples, they've set up a wedding registry.
Right.
which apparently is against NCAA rules.
They've had to make it visible only to Kyle's fiance, which is really, really beside the point.
Yeah, that, I mean, does that mean, like, Kyle's not going to get to, like, use the 15 blenders he gets? Do they think Kyle's going to, like, sell out the University of Virginia for some flatware? What are these people thinking?
When the best shooter in NBA history gets contact lenses, it makes the news because the best shooter in NBA history has apparently been dealing with poor eyesight for his entire career. Wait, has anyone checked to see if Steph Curry is just playing an April Fool's joke on us?
Apparently he has a condition called keratoconus, which basically what happens is over time your cornea changes shape. And he gets blurred vision, and nobody in the NBA is going to believe this, by the way. But apparently it's serious, and he's gone to contact lenses, which means we will be treated for the next few years to the occasional search for Steph Curry's contact lens, where everybody walks around looking at the floor like they could actually see it.
On Wednesday night, Atlanta Hawks veteran Vince Carter made his broadcast debut calling the Hawks 76ers game. Thing is, I'm not sure he remembered to tell his coach about his plans for the evening.
Coach telling me to sub.
Coach is trying to sub you in. Coach, he's in a suit.
Isn't calling a game that your current team is playing in some sort of conflict of interest?
Well, probably not. Those rules went out the window a long time ago. But I think his broadcast partners were very, very good about teasing him.
By all accounts, Vince Carter did a good job, but that doesn't mean he's ready to hang him up and switch to broadcasting full time. Carter says he's hoping to play for a 22nd season, which would be an NBA record. Do you think he'll get the chance?
I hope so, because he's still apparently useful. I mean, you heard the coach tried to sub him in. Yeah, I would like to see him play. If this is a record, I hope he gets it.
America's pastime has a new tradition, Charlie, and that tradition is booing Bryce Harper. I'm not at all surprised that he's being booed in Washington. Are you surprised that he's being booed by fans in Philadelphia as well?
No! I've been to games in Philadelphia. I know what those people are like. It's the Wild Kingdom down there. Yeah, he struck out and got booed. But at this point, I've got to wonder if Philadelphia fans aren't just doing performance pieces. I mean, you know, they're expected to boo the guy because he's making more money and he was their heart's desire. So naturally, they're expected to boo him. So they've done that now. So everybody can settle down.
A high school baseball coach in Utah has been put on leave. And really, I can't believe he hasn't just been fired outright. Would you like to explain what Steve Ross did?
His field was like really wet. And he decided that the way you dry something out is to like heat it up, right?
Right.
So what he did was he poured gasoline on the field and lit it on fire. Not apparently realizing that you will lose your field if you do this. Setting something on fire will dry it out, but it will turn it to ash. It's not terrific environmentally either, but the whole point is it's not going to achieve your primary purpose.
And finally, Charlie, the minor league Stockton Ports allowed fans to pick the walk-up songs for the opposing batters when the Ports faced the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes on opening day. Actually, the Ports are going to do this during every home game, but I just wanted to be able to say Rancho Cucamonga on the air.
I think you've done a fine job, and it's a worthy career goal, and I'm glad you've achieved it. This, of course, is open to all sorts of mischief. Which makes it great, by the way, which makes me want to go to Stockton, California.
And it's pick the only reason to go there.
Obscure Frank Zappa cuts for somebody's walk-up music.
And of course, they're charging a little money and it's going to go to their charity.
Sure.
So that's great.
Sure, absolutely.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time. And he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Wright Thompson Jr. is a senior writer for ESPN. His dad, Wright Thompson Sr., was a lawyer who enjoyed watching golf on TV. One event the pair watched together would later help Wright Jr. understand his dad. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Wright Thompson Sr. told his son stories about his own childhood on a farm in Bentonia, Mississippi.
He described a really rural life that, to me, growing up in the 80s, sounded not just from another decade, but from another century. He had three brothers, and they all had their own horse that they would ride to town.
Wright Jr.'s grandfather, a man known as Big Frazier, was tough on his kids. Wright Sr. was a good student and a star quarterback in high school, but his father only saw his shortcomings.
My father knew the dad that he had and knew the things he loved dearly about him. He also knew his flaws, and I think that when he created himself as a father, the kind of father he was going to be, it was based on both of those.
Wright Thompson Sr. showed his son what kind of father he was on a family trip to Destin, Florida.
And we were walking up and down the beach and all around all day, and I had a stuffed animal, Sweetie. He was a rabbit, and, you know, he was also sort of the color of sand, which becomes a problem because we get back to the condo and Sweetie's missing. And so my dad went and combed the sand.
Dad searched for hours looking for Sweetie.
Sweetie had a rough battle that night with the sand, but was discovered, and he came home with the stuffed animal.
When Wright got a little older, his dad would spring him from school so they could go fishing. They watched every James Bond movie. He lost count of how many times they watched The Guns of Navarone.
And I just always knew that he was going to be a rock.
On April 13th, 1986, when Wright Jr. was just 9, his dad called him into the room where he was watching the fourth and final round of the Masters.
It was just like, you need to watch this. You'll never forget this. This is unbelievable.
Maybe. Yes, sir!
Jack Nicklaus shot a 30 on the back nine to win by one stroke. Wright remembers that his father cried watching the 46-year-old Nicklaus become the oldest Masters winner. It was his sixth and final win at Augusta.
And I remember how emotional he was and not really understanding why.
It would be more than a decade before Wright Jr. would begin to understand the seed his dad had planted. After that day, Wright and his dad watched the Masters together every year. They bonded over the tournament, even if it was never as dramatic as it was in 1986. And Wright Sr. began to talk about how nice it would be to visit Augusta National Golf Course and see the azaleas and the clubhouse and Amen Corner in person. In 1996, Wright went off to college three states away, and in April of his freshman year, he watched a 21-year-old Tiger Woods win the Masters.
There it is, a win for the ages.
He called his dad, who said,
"Dude, are you watching this?" "Yes." And I remember that very clearly.
Thompson says picturing his dad in the same room where they had watched the last 11 Masters made it feel like home wasn't quite so far away. Wright Thompson started covering the Masters in 2003 as a writer for the Kansas City Star.
You get to see the stuff that was always sort of elusively just out of frame.
His dad wanted to know about everything.
I suddenly had information for him that he didn't have. I knew stuff he didn't know.
Stuff like, what's on the tables at Augusta National's clubhouse restaurant?
I don't know if you know what Durkee's is. It's a sandwich condiment. My grandmother and mother would not eat a sandwich ever without Durkee's on it. It is a very, very Southern thing. So anyway, when I called my dad and was like, there's Durkee's on the table, it just, you know, his head, he exploded.
Wright and his dad talked about visiting the course together, maybe even during the Masters.
That was always the plan.
But later that year, they got some bad news.
He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He described getting that news and was like, I know what the odds are on this particular one, and this is not good.
So Wright and his dad decided to make some trips. They went fishing in Arkansas. They talked some more about going to Augusta. But then his dad started treatment. Wright Sr. went out of his way to cheer up the other patients, especially the ones who had to endure the treatments without family or friends present.
The guy was a walking party. You know, I mean, like, if you had to describe him with one noun, I think it would be ringleader.
Everyone in the ward knew him by name.
I mean, he was a warrior. No effing pity. No martyrdom. No woe is me. No complaining. No giving up.
Wright Thompson Sr. fought hard for several months.
And then he beat it, which is just no one beats it.
Wright Jr. got the good news in April 2004 while he was at Augusta covering the Masters.
And so I was like, let's go somewhere.
The obvious choice would have been to meet in Augusta at the golf course Wright Sr. wanted so badly to visit. But the remission made them feel like they had all the time in the world.
Doesn't everything lull us into thinking we have all the time in the world? So we decided to go down to Destin, Florida, the same place where he'd rescued Sweetie. And that was just a really magical trip. You know, I brought him a windbreaker from the Augusta Pro Shop, and we talked very specifically about going to the Masters.
Just 3 months later, Wright got a call from his mother.
It came back fast, man.
Wright's dad was too sick for him to travel that summer. On September 29th, 2004, Wright Thompson Sr. died. He was just 58 years old.
After my dad died, my mom started finding flashlights all over the house. And she realized that he had gone to Walmart one day and just bought every size flashlight they had and hidden them all over the house because he knew he was dying and didn't want her to ever be scared of the dark.
Wright was racked with guilt that he never brought his dad to see the azaleas, the rolling hills, and the loblolly pines of Augusta National Golf Course.
I got worse before I got better, you know? I struggled for a long time.
But in addition to the flashlights for his mom, Wright Sr. left something for his son to discover. The following April, Wright Jr. returned to Augusta to cover the Masters.
I took a pair of his shoes and walked the course in them, which is weird in hindsight and sort of oddly pathetic now that I say it out loud.
Wright says at first those return trips to Augusta made his regret even stronger. But then he realized that wasn't fair to his father.
The more I go back, you realize that focusing on the end of the experience is not only stupid and counterproductive and leads you nowhere, it ultimately is the greatest insult to the best parts of that person who you wish was still here.
Wright says with every return visit, his guilt subsided.
My trips to Augusta feel like an extension of the best of my father, not some weird extended funeral to celebrate the worst.
He began to understand why the 1986 Masters was so important to his dad.
Together, watching the triumph of Jack over time and all of these big existential forces, we had a moment that was so loaded with meaning that he didn't even have to explain it. And I think it was designed to just plant this stuff so I could unpack it in my own time.
Wright got married in 2006. He and his wife began thinking about starting a family. So after the end of the following Masters tournament, he stopped into the Augusta National Golf Shop.
I purchased a onesie. It's an Augusta National onesie. And it was my own down payment on the idea that I would learn from him both in how to be a father and also in how not to wait too long.
A decade after buying that onesie, Wright became a dad. A trip with his daughter to Augusta this year is out of the question because
we'd get thrown out because she likes to make noise and run around, and the patrons are not allowed to run.
Wright says he'll take his daughter to Augusta when she's a little older. But in the meantime,
we're building a little place in Montana where we can fish all the time. And one of the big motivations for me in doing that is this isn't going to be something that I'm going to do later. You can't ever count on later. This is something we're going to do now.
One day, years from now, Wright's daughter will cast a fly to a wild Montana trout or sink a long putt at Amen Corner. And she'll think about her dad and her granddad and how they planted seeds that she came to appreciate much, much later.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Wright Thompson's new book is called The Cost of These Dreams. It includes an essay about his father and Augusta National called Holy Ground. We'll have links to both at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.